With that, I believe we are ready to start this session. Once more, I would like to remind everyone to keep your phones on mute by making sure you have *6 pressed to mute your phone, and then during the question and answer sessions, you can hit *6 to unmute your phone and *6 to mute it once again. And I also remind everyone to please do not put us on hold. At this time, I would like to turn the time over to our moderator, Dr. Heather Henry with the Superfund program, who will introduce today's speakers. Dr. Henry?
Thanks, Justin. Is my sound okay?
Yep, you sound great. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. I want to welcome everybody to the Superfund Research Program Spring 2009 Risky Learning Series titled Computational Toxicology, New Approaches for the 21st Century. This Risky Learning seminar series is a collaboration between our organization, the Superfund Research Program, and the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation, OSREDI. And this provides the opportunity to share research emanating from both the EPA and the SRP. So this computational toxicology series was inspired by the 2009 EPA Office of Science Advisor Report titled The Strategic Plan for Evaluating Toxicity of Chemicals and the NRC's panel, Toxicity Testing in the 21st Century, which called for the agency transition from traditional animal toxicology toward emerging technologies such as computational toxicology. So if you happen to miss our first session featured that occurred on June 24th, the audio archive is now available and is on the CLUIN website. And this session was titled Computational Toxicology, an Introduction to Key Concepts and Approaches. And this featured NIEHS Director Dr. Linda Birnbaum, Brown University's Kim Buckelhide, and EPA NCCT's Bob Cavlock. Again, that's the archive. The audio archive is available on the CLUIN website. And our next session will cover computational approaches to chemical prioritization and use of rapid assay techniques. And those presenters will be Dr. Yvonne Rustin from UNC Chapel Hill and Richard Judson from EPA's NCCT. So that session will be on July 7th, and we encourage you to register soon. The website is open through CLUIN, so go ahead and register for that. And, of course, these sessions tend to fill up quickly, so we ask you to do that as soon as you can. So now, without further ado, let's move on to today's session, which will hopefully provide our listeners a better understanding of how one goes from cells to systems to dose response modeling. And our first speaker today is Dr. Melvin Anderson with the Hamner Institute for Environmental Sciences. Dr. Anderson graduated from Brown University with a bachelor in chemistry and from Cornell with a PhD in biochemistry. He's a certified industrial hygienist with the American Board of Industrial Hygiene and a diplomat with the American Board of Toxicology. His research focuses on developing biologically based models for uptake, distribution, metabolism, and biological effects of drugs and chemicals and their application to safety assessments and quantitative risk health risk assessments. In recent years, his research emphasis has been on developing mathematical descriptions of control of genetic circuitry and the dose response and risk assessment implications of these control processes. The title of his talk today is Computational Systems Biology and Dose Response Modeling, Dioxins and Induction of Proteins in Liver. So you can move on to slide 2. And Dr. Anderson, if you're out there, thank you for joining us, and I'll turn it over to you now.
Thank you very much, Heather. Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's a pleasure to be with you and the people out in the internet ether to talk about computational systems biology today. If you move on to the slide number 3, which provides the abstract, I won't read that. The key concepts today is that I'm going to talk about a problem that is the response of the liver to dioxin that has troubled me for the last 20 years of my career, and I'm going to talk about new tools, computational tools and systems biology that have become available in the last 10 years that promise to help us develop a better understanding of these processes quantitatively and with their application to put that understanding to use to understand dose response. Much of the work, especially in the latter part of this talk, has been done as part of my responsibilities leading a computational core in the Superfund basic research program that has contributions from investigators at Michigan State, from EPA and myself, in fact all three of those of us talking today. There's a website that's listed at my organization, the Hamner, where we provided a course in computational biology that arose out of our efforts with the Superfund Basic Research Program course. The next slide shows this. This is slide 4, the exposure dose response relationship. And with dioxin, we would talk about exposure in the world leading to uptake, dose to tissues such as the immune system or the liver, molecular interactions that occur through an AH receptor, and downstream events. We're interested in understanding induction processes in the liver and then how that leads to adverse consequences such as liver tumors in rats. Slide 5 shows the complications that arose in the 1980s when there were efforts to understand the dosimetry of dioxin to various tissues. The y-axis shows the percent of dose per gram tissue in the liver and percent of dose per gram tissue in the fat. The x-axis is a single dose. Animals were evaluated after 7 days. And instead of seeing straight lines, which you would expect for normal systems that were, as we would call them, linear, there's an increase in the percent that goes to the liver as dose increases and a decrease in the percent found in fat. This sign of dose dependency suggested some change was occurring in the liver. In figure 6, it just emphasizes that dioxin caused an increase in proteins in the liver that were capable of sequestering dioxin to the liver. We now know that's cytochrome P450-1A2. The question became, how could we change the pharmacokinetic descriptions we had for distribution of dioxin to account for induction of genes in the presence of this small molecule? The next slide, 7, shows the beginning of this process, which is just the description of the block diagram for a pharmacokinetic model in which dioxin can flow in the blood, and the blood flows are given by these C terms, the Q terms, such as QR, the blood flow to a richly perfused tissue, QS to the slowly perfused tissue, QF to the fat. The boxes themselves represent both tissues and equations and models. And each of the tissues can store dioxin. And in the liver, there's both free dioxin and bound dioxin. And then depending on the species, there's more or less metabolism over unit time, shown by the large arrow at the bottom of the slide. In slide 8, it talks about the first efforts that were made to develop a transcriptional model for control of dioxin-responsive or AH-responsive proteins in the liver. Dioxin interacts with a receptor, the AH receptor, aryl hydrocarbon receptor. That interaction and that complex leads to a complex that can bind to DREs, dioxin-responsive elements, shown at the top line of this figure. That alters the concentration of messenger RNA, which can be subsequently translated into proteins. Dioxin controls a variety, a battery of genes in various tissues. Two of them that have been studied extensively in the liver are cytochromes P450-1A1, which actually is induced from a very low basal level by almost 10,000-fold in some cases, or cytochrome P450-1A2, which has a significant basal level and whose concentration is increased by about 10-fold. As I said, 1A2 binds dioxin. To develop the description of transcriptional control, we have to actually account for dioxin, PCDD, here in this slide, the second line, binding to the AH receptor with some affinity. So KB1 is a dissociation constant, the affinity of dioxin for the AH receptor. And then the third line that has to bind the site dioxin-responsive elements. And then there has to be some relationship of that binding to rate of transcription, which is shown by this DRE, dioxin response element occupancy, given by a traditional Michaelis-Menten type curve, a rectangular hyperbola. The next slide just shows the equation for the rate of change. This is slide 9 for the rate of change of protein concentration with respect to time. There's a basal production rate, K0 in the equation, a maximally induced rate, K max here, and that's actually induced by a Hill equation, that is concentration to the N over a binding constant raised to the power N plus the concentration. And then all of the protein is eliminated with some degradation rate. These models were developed by myself and colleagues at Syntex at the time. I was working for the government, the Air Force, and Lieutenants Postenbach and Han Wing Leung were at Syntex. Slide 10 shows that with a description of this kind, we could successfully describe the shapes of these curves, get understanding or get at least estimates of how strongly dioxin bound the receptor, how strongly the receptor dioxin complex had to interact with DNA, the extent of induction, and how strongly the dioxin was binding to the cytochrome P450-1A2. One of the questions is this a reasonable approach? When we do this, when we did this, the value of N in that equation was 1, so it appeared to be a rectangular hyperbola. This predicts a proportionate increase in the amount of 1A2 enzymes throughout the liver as dose increases. Unfortunately, in the next slide, 11, there was evidence that shows that this just isn't true. What happens when you give dioxin, which interacts with the AH receptor, or if you give phenobarbital, that induces CYP2B1 and interacts with the CAR receptor, or if you give ligands that interact with the peroxisome proliferating activating receptor, you see regional induction. The most sensitive part of the liver for induction is the central lobular region. That's shown kind of on the slide as you go up in dose from the control to 0.1 microgram per kilogram, the central lobular induction. The induction spreads out towards what's called the mid-zonal areas of the liver and finally fills the liver. So that had to be taken into account. The next slide, 12, just shows liver structure and a characteristic hexagonal structure with blood flowing in through the portal vein, hepatic artery, and bile going out in the bile duct shown on the right side, and then that blood moving into the central lobular area. The challenge is to take that structure and form some geometric picture of it, which is, and make predictions in different regions. What had to be done with the pharmacokinetic model, and I'm on slide 13, is actually to create descriptions of the liver as having subcompartments going from the periportal area, that's where the blood comes in, to the central lobular. So at the bottom of this picture, it shows that liver, that length along the liver from the blood coming into the periportal to the exiting at the central lobular, described in five different compartments, 1 through 5. And each has an equation, as we showed in the earlier slide. The next slide shows the challenge that was drawing these in some form to give hexagonal structures. I actually did this by creating these structures using polar coordinates. I studied polar coordinates in 1963 and thought I would never, ever have to use them. In fact, I hoped I would never, ever have to use them. But they were critical in developing the structure we could use in figure 14. And then in slide 15, it shows this process of modeling induction where you model the degree of induction and then use some tool to paint the picture. So this is painting with pretty pink colors, the central lobular regions being the small, the center rosette there, and then the intensity of staining moving out. So this was a significant step for us in allowing us to look at this regional induction. It also said that instead of having Hill coefficient steepness of 1, it required a much higher value of N, 5. But it's still very empirical and doesn't capture the biology, nor does it capture much of our understanding of the computational, of the manner, the quantitative manner in which we have control of transcription. By 1999, we knew that with positive feedback loops, and this next slide 16 shows a positive feedback loop, where in the center there's a HR, that's a hormone receptor complex that can form a dimer, and that dimer is shown as HR2, can bind to hormone responsive elements shown in the center of this picture, and that upregulates the receptor and forms a positive feedback loop. This is work that was published by Hugh Barton and myself. In slide 17, this autoinduction is shown that this autoinduction can produce very steep dose response curves as we look at reporter gene concentrations on the y-axis of the figure versus ligand concentration. And this is autoregulation increasing the amount of induced protein up to tenfold. Again, this is simulation tools that were being used and allowed us to provide insight into mechanisms by which biology can give rise to switches, not necessarily how it was going on in the liver with dioxin. And slide 18 now comes the Superfund Basic Research Program, our computational core, along with our colleagues. We're looking at a series of studies on computational systems biology that appeared in Nature Systems Biology User's Guide. A paper by Wingreen and Botstein at Princeton talks about using 10 key papers in computational systems biology, describing cellular functions as a series of equations, some differential equations and other types. We actually put together a literature, a club to go through those papers. Each time we went through a paper, we being a group from EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and ourselves, and this is slide 19, produced a model for it, discussed this, and then decided afterwards that we actually would put together a course. The course was organized by my colleagues Cheng Zhang, Sudhin Bhattacharya, and Courtney Woods, shown here, and provided actually here at the Hamner a year ago in September and will be provided again. It talks about critical concepts in systems biology, ultrasensitivity, feedback, feed-forward loops, nonlinear dynamics. I'm going to go through quickly and just highlight some of the terminology here and then return to dioxin. The website, again, is listed at the bottom of this page, and this is the cover of the brochure. Ultrasensitivity, it's a word that basically means that things occur with a dose response that's steeper than you would expect from a Michaelis-Menten form. So that's the blue curve with Michaelis-Menten, that is response max times concentration over a half response constant plus concentration. Again, the N values or the Hill coefficients increase here. One of the questions, though, is that with hemoglobin, we know that this is cooperativity with N values approaching 4 because of multiple binding of ligands to the hemoglobin molecule, which is an alpha-beta dimer. It has 4 heme binding pockets. But ultrasensitivity does not usually develop that way. One major process by which biochemical and cellular systems become ultrasensitive, shown in figure 22, of these MAP kinase cascades, which seem to be extremely prevalent in eukaryotic systems in which there's a series of phosphorylating steps from a MAP kinase, shown at the top, to another protein, a MAP kinase, and finally a mitogen activated protein kinase at the bottom. These steps have dual phosphorylation, and shown at the right is this cartoon indicating that the steepness of the response to the input signal increases as you go down the cascade, so that finally the MAP kinase cascades have a N value that approaches 6 or even higher in some cases. This is one way that we get ultrasensitive motifs. The next slide, 23, shows that this motif is very widely used. The left side shows the stimulus going to a phosphorylated substrate in a general way. The rest of these columns show progesterone, platelet-derived growth factor, integrin signaling, stress responses, interleukin responses, and a variety of others that are all controlled by these MAP kinases. MAP kinases are an ubiquitous signaling motif that gives rise to ultrasensitivity. When you couple ultrasensitivity with feedback, you get something called bistability, where cells can reside in one state or another but can't live in an in-between state. This is equivalent, for instance, to differentiation, but there are a number of processes where this bistability is important. Bistability has been discussed since the 1940s. Delbruck, Minot, and Jacob, in their work with black operon, talked about how gene regulatory circuits can explain the cell differentiation. And a fairly famous paper now by Thomas showed how positive feedback loops give rise to this behavior. Slide 25 shows the relationship of activation of critical MAP kinase by frog oocytes in response to progesterone. And this shows a distribution as you go up in concentration, which is going down as you look at the individual figures from 0 micromolar to 8 micromolar. You see a shift of material that is either 0 phosphorylation or completely phosphorylated. That is, there's only 2 states. This paper occurred and was published in Science and discussed N value of the order of 30, which basically means there's a switch. In this case, shown in figure 26, the way the switch operates is there's a MAP kinase cascade, which is shown here as MOS, going to this protein MEK, and then finally to a mitogen activator protein kinase. And it activates a protein which is involved in a double negative feedback loop. And so it activates RSK and then shuts off a negative feedback loop and provides a positive signal to the MOS protein developing what's called a bistable system. The platelet-derived growth factor sample shown in figure 27 has the positive feedback loop as you go through the mitogen activated kinase through cytoplasmic phospholipase A2. So ultrasensitivity and MAP kinase with feedback produces bistability. The work by Thomas shows this bistability in figure 28. This is where we have regulation of a messenger RNA M and protein P and a positive feedback loop. So as the message is upregulated, shown by the green box in the middle of this figure, there's synthesis of the protein, which actually acts to enhance the its own regulation. So this is a positive feedback loop. There's 2 equations, one for production of the mRNA, one for production of the protein. Figure 29 just shows how bistability is described here. If you take the second equation for the change of protein, there's both a term for synthesis rate in red and a degradation rate in blue, and it's shown in the little boxes. And in the figure, that synthesis rate is a linear function of the protein. P is the x-axis, whereas the synthesis rate itself is a sigmoidal function, as shown by the equation at the top. They have to intersect in 3 points, and the important thing to know is that that means there's three steady states, only 2 of which, the ones that are shown filled in red, are stable and 1 unstable steady state. Bistability, it exists in either form. Slide 30 shows this plot of stimulus versus response as you increase the stimulus, shown in the lower panel, the lower light blue panel. It creeps up to a point at which it actually just shifts. This is a process which is the basis of differentiation, determination of cell fates. Hysteresis means that the upward-going curve, shown by the red arrow with the head to the right, is different from the downward-going curve. So the upward-going dose-response curve moves out to the dashed line, up to the second blue level, and then goes on. And coming back, it just follows the dashed line and actually never returns. So this is both bistable and irreversible. The other key studies that we've been involved with in slide 31 shows in the bottom D, general cellular control schemes, work done by my colleague Cheng Zhang as part of our projects here, including the Superfund project. We have transcriptional factors that control stress response genes leading to the regulation of a control variable. That could be true for oxidative stress, heat shock, or hypoxic responses, or for controlling concentrations of key ligands in the body, estrogen or androgen, or something that actually normally interacts with the AH receptor. Slide 32 shows the general behavior of a controller, and the Y is a control variable and S is a stressor. In this case, it could be oxidative stress. And this requires negative feedback embedded in a loop. And we have a term called loop gain, which is shown by the terms R1, R2, and R3 here. And it turns out that to get good response behavior from a negative feedback loop of this kind, you need ultra-sensitivity that's embedded within each of the steps in the feedback loop. So negative feedback, the ability of negative feedback to control input as shown in the Y versus S curve. Remember, Y is a control variable such as peroxide in the cell, and S is a stressor such as oxidative stress coming into the cell. For homeostatic response, you want that curve to bend down and be held fairly flat over a range instead of a linear increase with the loop gain of zero here. For good homeostasis, we need ultra-sensitivity embedded in the network. That was a rather surprise to me. The last thing is these transcriptional networks shown in figure 33. Dioxin and its protein partners, AHR, aryl hydrocarbon receptor, and ARNT, interact through network. This is a theoretical network where we have genes Y, Z, and Y being affected by control units. The first one there in the upper left says IFFL. That's a what's called an incoherent feed-forward loop. Yuri Alon, who's written several really beautiful papers and also has a book on computational systems biology, which is, in his words, the description of circuits and how they function and the both functional aspects of the output of the circuit as well as characteristics of the design to get particular function through different types of circuit structures. So we have with dioxin a cascading series of gene expression levels through a series of coherent and incoherent loops. When you put those together into a combination of transcriptional networks, such as in figure 34, what you find is that although with high doses at the top of the page, you can get a series of behaviors in which groups of genes increase and stay increased, and others have transient increases, such as the three on the right in the top, that as you change dose, you get a very complicated relationship of individual genes one to another, suggesting that the dose response for activation of these pathways has to be carefully considered with respect to the genes that are altered at any particular dose and time. The last, with dioxin, we know that the effects are going on in a complicated tissue, the liver. Slide 35 shows a different way of representing the liver from the periportal area called zone 1 here to the central lobular or pericentral area called zone 3. There are other characteristics. The cells have different characteristics throughout. One is ploidy. Their cells have just a single nucleus in the periportal area where they're believed to actually be generated from hepatic stem cells. They move through, and as they move along this conveyor belt, finally they reach the pericentral region. There are very significant differences in ploidy. That is, there's two copies of chromosomes per cell in zone one, and depending on the animal species, a good number more by the time you get to the central lobular region. So there's changes in gene dosage throughout. So, 36, slide 36. What I'd like to do is just put into words what appears to go on with dioxin, but instead of using the terminology I would have 10 years ago, use the terminology that's being developed through the work of computational systems biology. The response to dioxin is likely activation of a negative feedback loop that maintains homeostasis for a bioactive ligand. In this case, we can't metabolize the ligand, so there are other consequences. Point two, high loop gain in the system is achieved by ultrasensitivity in the activation of the phase 1, 2, and 3 enzymes. And this likely occurs through MAPK activation and feedback initiated by stability. There's some question of whether it's simply ultrasensitive or bistable. The variability induction across the liver is likely due to the differentiation state of hepatocytes, which could be determined by ploidy, and that is gene dosage. And lastly, the transcriptional networks activated within the liver are likely to differ across the liver acinus, the liver sinusoid, and may include proliferative responses and hyperplasia once you activate parts of the liver within the periportal region. Slide 37 shows kind of the thinking with respect to dose-dependent transitions, that at low doses in the liver, very little would be expected to occur because the bistability is present and you would not turn the cell to an on position. At some middle dose, shown with metabolic responses here, the perturbation, which is shown as exposure, tissue dose, biological interaction, the perturbation at the top, is significant enough to activate cells within the central lobular region. And at high doses, with the full activation throughout the liver, there are alterations in cell growth and subsequent changes that could lead to carcinogenicity. That's a working hypothesis described now in modern computational biology terminology, computational systems biology. 38, I'm done. For more information, you'll be able to see many of these chapters described in many of these topics described in detail in a book that's been written with support. Both individuals here at the Hamner and myself have contributed chapter and reviews, Quantitative Modeling and Toxicology. And this work and the efforts that went into my activities with the book have been supported once again by the Superfund Basic Research Program. And I have to emphasize very strongly the contributions by the three individuals, Chung Zhang, Sudhin Bhattacharya, and Courtney Wood. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Dr. Anderson. At this time, we have an opportunity to take some questions, and I'll let you know if you're a simulcast listener or if you're logged on through the internet, you'll notice that there's a little question mark in the upper right corner. If you press that, then you can send a question through simulcast. Otherwise, you can take your phone off mute, and by doing that, you press star 6, and you can state your name and organization and ask your question. So at this time, I'll turn it over to the phone lines and see if there are any questions out there. Okay, there appear to not be very many questions. This is not a very inquisitive audience. I have a question, Dr. Anderson. How does this line up with what we observe in humans? You know, the different toxicological pathways that are observed in humans exposed to dioxin.
There are significant species differences with respect to induction. There are hepatic responses. We don't, in humans, have the same hepatic response with respect to the cytochrome P450-1A1, nor with these receptor-mediated compounds that affect the liver do we seem to have anywhere near the magnitude of response. I can't say that entirely for dioxin, but that's generally with respect to these receptor-mediated processes. There are a variety of endpoints that are noted in people, high doses, things like chloracne and suggestion of metabolic diseases and immunological defects at lower doses. I would emphasize that one of the goals of the effort that I've been involved with, while I've described efforts aimed at understanding hepatic effects in animals, that the tools are equally applicable to the interaction of dioxin with receptors in other tissues, asking questions about the nature of the interaction, the components of the circuitry, such as MAP kinases that would be involved to alter transcriptional signaling, the nature of that change, whether it's just kind of graded alteration in an ongoing response versus an ultrasensitive change or a bistable change. All of those questions are similar, and we're developing the tools that allow us to look at that so we can put into context the relative sensitivity of human cells versus animal cells to respond to dioxin. And in that regard, I guess one of the approaches that we've been trying to look at now is how we could do in vitro studies using tissue-derived stem cells that are in a differentiation state equivalent to a periportal region, and be able to dose ones from mouse, rat, or human, and then look at the characteristics of the dose response.
Rory Conley here. Can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
Mel, on your slide 37, the one where you show the overall scheme, including the adaptive stress responses.
Yes.
As you and I both are very, very familiar, dose response and time course behaviors are key determinants of risk for any given exposure. And I'm wondering if you could just make maybe a few comments that amplify the part of your figure that where it says adaptive stress response.
Yeah.
So how broadly covered are the various kinds of environmental stress with respect to sort of built-in stress responses? And what do you think the implications of that kind of adaptive biology is for dose response and therefore for health risk?
Well, I'm quite comfortable responding to the what do I think part of it.
So in this
slide, as I mentioned, the goal was to suggest that there's a fundamental kind of difference with the liver response versus the first activation in the central lobular region versus the complete activation of the liver extending out to the periportal. That the first part of the liver, the response is simply to control the concentration of the bioactive ligand, and the consequences here for health and adversity are probably minimal. It's an adaptive response. Dan Niebert in 1994 wrote a paper saying that he felt that the vast majority, maybe all, of the xenobiotic metabolizing enzymes that were being activated by drugs and other compounds were simply mimicking some natural ligand, bioactive ligand, and taking part in a control process. We know, for instance, with a whole variety of stressors, and that was shown in that picture where I looked at loop gain, that there's a almost an engineering component to how you recognize the stress, have early changes, which probably represent the upregulation of regulatory genes, for instance, for antioxidants or for refolding proteins. And that is just part of a normal process involved in maintenance of homeostasis. What seems to be also present, though, is that if you mean that they only have a certain capacity, and as that capacity, as you begin to reach capacity in that inducible antioxidant loop, you activate subsequent downstream events such as apoptosis or inflammation. So there's lovely work that's been done by Andre Nau and colleagues at the University of California at Los Angeles on what they call hierarchical oxidative stress. And it's basically levels of stress where there's little response, then levels where you have adaptation and changes in glutathione and glutathione transferase, and then finally regions where the stress is so intense that you move on to inflammation. Above that, then apoptosis. I think that from my point of view, most of what we do in toxicology is an evaluation of these stress responses. And having tools that look at this transition between no effect and an effect that's actually being regulated to maintain homeostasis and then adversity that are important. That's this idea of dose-dependent transitions. I think the risk assessment approaches have to differ for full adversity versus what we will do when we see some intermediate response. We have not yet, as a community, come to grips with how that should be done. That's one of the key pieces that's going to have to move forward based on some of the ideas from toxicity testing in the 21st century. And different approaches that would have to be applied depending on the nature of these endpoints.
So at this time, I'd like to take a couple questions from the simulcast participants. And one came in about slide 37, which was the slide you were just referring to. So I'll go ahead and ask that question. This question came from Amy Purbeck from Michigan Department of Environmental Quality in Lansing, Michigan. She wanted to know, what are the cutoffs for the high, mid, and low dose? If you have that available.
You mean for dioxin in general?
Well, she doesn't specify, but I'm guessing for dioxin.
Right. So I've written a couple of papers on this issue. You know, we talk about dose response and understanding the response in regions of low dose. To be really extremely pedantic, which I can be at times, the issue is we want to look at incidence, kind of incidence dose curves in the region of low incidence. So what we're really talking about when we talk about low doses, mid doses, and high doses are regions in which, in the low doses where we're not affecting virtually anybody, maybe below thresholds. The mid doses, when we're just beginning, and it might be to see early responses, could be in a large number of individuals, but the adverse consequences are unlikely to be seen in anybody. High doses are doses when we're getting to sufficient levels that we expect to see, even at low incidence in the population, some truly adverse response. I don't know what the numbers would be for dioxin, Amy, but that's more or less the thinking behind figures of this kind. A figure of this kind does appear in toxicity testing in the 21st century, and I adapted it with different words here.
Okay, so it's kind of based on the effect that you get.
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thanks for answering that. There's another couple of questions from online participants. This one came from Dr. David Williams from the University of, from Oregon State University in Corvallis. The question is, what are the implications of your model for linear extrapolated dose modeling of carcinogens? And by this, he means to 10-6 incidents?
Yes, 10 to the minus 6.
10 to the minus 6, okay.
Well, David, that's a That's a great question that we've been stewing over for years. For me, this figure and the efforts by toxicity testing in the 21st century really suggests that approaches for risk assessment have to change. That when we do high-dose studies and see carcinogenicity, like even low incidence in animals, a figure like this really tells us that qualitatively we don't expect to see the same thing at lower doses, that there are transitions between all the components that have to come together to support carcinogenicity, that is the activation of adaptive stress, movement to the periportal area, proliferation, hypertrophy. That's different from the earlier responses, which may be activation of a more limited set of genes. So it suggests that you should have caution in assuming that you can make a correlation, a quantitative correlation from high doses to low doses. Something qualitative changes in that range. The reverse of this is really one of the significant points of discussion for new approaches that would use in vitro tools for trying to do risk assessment. If instead we were looking at when we see perturbations and when we see metabolic responses and trying not to let them get so intense, the perturbations so intense that they're likely to lead on to toxicity, we won't be predicting 1 in 10 to the minus 6 tumor ranges. We'll actually be forced to look at what we would consider to be safe ranges of exposure. And I think some of these new initiatives should be thought of as new initiatives in altering our safety assessment approach rather than our risk assessment approach. It's a really good question, and it's one that many people are wrestling with at the moment.
Thanks. Are there any more questions from the phone line? If there are, you can take your phone off mute by pressing star 6. State your name and your organization, and go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, this is Louise White from Health Canada. I was just wondering how this concept of hormesis fits into computational toxicology. Does it make sense? Can you talk about it in terms of computational toxicology?
I think I can say a few words about it.
Could you repeat the question? I'm having a hard time hearing.
The question that I'm going to respond to is that there's a concept of hormesis, and does the computational modeling approaches here help us to understand what hormesis might be and how it might influence the way we look at risk assessment? Is that a good restatement of the question, Louise?
Yeah, it's much better than mine.
I actually have been pretty good friends with Ed Calabrese and discussed hormesis with him over many years. Sometimes I think we tend to define hormesis too narrowly. From my point of view, hormesis, if you look at it in a more general way, means that we can have complicated shapes of dose response curves, and especially in these regions where we just begin to see adaptive changes. To the extent that we look at it as a potentially more general phenomena that influences dose response, I think that we have several examples that work that's been done actually by Rory Conley, who will speak later, along with Verna Lutz and other work on dioxin carcinogenicity in the liver, and then extensive work in the last couple of years by my colleague Chung Zhang, showing different conditions under which hormesis is actually expected. In some cases, it's where two mechanisms are coming together to influence the final outcome, and those two mechanisms have different dose response curves. Chung Zhang has showed that with these negative feedback loops, that if they include something called feed-forward signaling, which is common in engineering and control of mechanical systems, that they naturally give rise to curves which are multiphasic and would be called Hormetic. He has completed a paper that's in press now at Toxicology and Applied Pharmacology that describes that in some detail. So kind of the short answer is that the computational systems biology approach to understanding cell signaling and cell response is beginning to show us many ways that we can develop hormesis type, hormetic type curves and begin to think of how they should be used in risk assessments.
Yeah, this is Rory Conley. May I add a comment here?
Surely.
Okay, so I'll just chime in and follow on what Mel just said, and I certainly agree with everything Mel said in response to the question. I just will make the comment that I think it's actually unfortunate that if you read the hormesis literature, there's virtually no reference to homeostasis or the kind of mechanistic biology that Mel's been describing in his presentation. And one frankly gets something of an impression from that literature that hormesis is somehow or other different or separate from homeostasis. And I'm far from convinced that that's the case. I'm much more inclined to think that Mel and his colleagues are on the right track with their consideration of the probability that hormesis and homeostasis are probably different aspects of the same biological processes.
Thanks for that insight. We do have one more simulcast question, and since it is very specific to Dr. Anderson's talk, I'd like to ask that one right now. And then if any of you out there do have additional questions, there will be time after the next set of talks to ask those questions. And at any time, you can still submit your questions via ClueIn if you hit the question mark key. So the question is with regard to slide 13, Dr. Anderson.
Okay.
And the question is, in modeling the regional induction of the liver, does this type of model account for three-dimensionality, or is this more a model of flat cut through the liver, similar to tissue slice? And this is from Katie Goyack from ExxonMobil Biomedical Sciences in Annandale, New Jersey.
Okay. Well, thank you for the question, Katie. So it actually represents what you would get if you had a two-dimensional cut through a hexagonal asinus, but then it's given kind of volume structure by depth. That's how you would do it. And it does represent an abstraction down to two dimensions from a presumed three-dimensional structure. I hope that's clear. That's what we did. One of the more intriguing things for me right now is that much of what I showed you is just what I would call seat-of-the-pants descriptions. We knew what we had to describe and started going after it, went to the literature, organized the information, put it together, made it work. 10 years, now we're 10 years downstream, and we actually can go get these cells. We can do it by laser capture microdissection if we want to look at gene expression in them after dosing with dioxin. It appears right now, at least in my discussions with Dr. Lola Reed from UNC, that these cells can be derived from stem cells, liver stem cells that are found in a place called, the Canal of Herring, in the periportal region, and can be isolated, and then they can be grown out in such a way that you can get periportal-like or centrolobular-like cells. So there's an opportunity now both to do this kind of modeling as well as to get down to the level of experimental detail to give this quantitative description much more flesh. And I'm quite happy I've lived long enough to have this opportunity.
Great, thanks. Let's go ahead then and move on to our next talk. This is going to be a co-presentation from Dr. Norb Kaminsky as well as Dr. Rory Connolly, who you've heard chime in a couple times already. So let me introduce Dr. Norb Kaminsky first. He's a professor of Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology and director of the Superfund research program at Michigan State University. He received his BA in chemistry from Loyola University in Chicago and his master's in toxicology and PhD in toxicology and physiology from North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. Dr. Kaminsky joined the Michigan State faculty in 1993. He was also affiliated with the Medical College of Virginia in their Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology from 1985 to 1999. So a primary emphasis of his laboratory is directed toward the elucidation of molecular mechanisms by which drugs and chemicals modulate signal transduction cascades and gene expression during lymphocyte activation and differentiation. His full bio is available on the CLUIN webpage for this seminar, and I encourage you to look at it. He's had many awards and honors. And what I've said just says a tiny bit of what he's done. Also co-presenting with Dr. Kaminsky is Dr. Rory Connolly, a senior research biologist in the U.S. EPA's National Center for Computational Toxicology in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. He's also an adjunct professor of biomathematics at North Carolina State University and a faculty affiliate with the Department of Environmental and Radiological Health Sciences at Colorado State University. Dr. Connolly maintains an active interest in teaching, having most recently given a 3-day course on simulation modeling and risk assessment in Germany and lectures on risk assessment at North Carolina State University. So among his honors, Dr. Connolly received the U.S. Society of Toxicology Layman Award for Lifetime Achievement in Risk Assessment in 2005 and has been a diplomat of the American Board of Toxicology since 1980. So at this time, I would like to thank both of these guys for taking the time to share their research with us, and I'll pass it off to Dr. Kaminsky, who's going to start.
Hello, Heather, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear.
Good. Well, let me begin by thanking you for the introduction and also thanking the NIEHS Superfund research program as well as the EPA for this opportunity to share some of the results from the Superfund grant that is administered at MSU, but also has investigators and investigative teams at a number of other institutions, including the Hamner, the EPA, Rutgers, and Purdue. And I just want to emphasize the major strength that I think of the Superfund research program is it really allows funding for bringing together large multi-investigator teams to really address some what I think are some fundamental issues in toxicology. And so the second part of this presentation today in some ways is really a case study looking at the effects of dioxins on B cell function. And so what I believe Rory and I are going to try to do today is tell you a little bit about a research program within our Superfund grant that is focused on developing a computational description of the molecular signaling by which dioxins impair B cell differentiation and ultimately antibody responses. And so what I'm going to do in the first part of this talk is try to provide a little bit of background in terms of B cell biology in the context of dioxin and dioxin-like compounds. So with that very, very brief introduction. If we could go to slide 40, this is a slide I think that Rory put in, which is, I don't know, if Rory, if I should read this, but I quickly will since I think it's important if you put it in. Although this work was reviewed by EPA and approved for publication, it may not necessarily reflect official agency policy. So with that very quick disclaimer, if we could move to slide 42, just again, by way of background, dioxin and dioxin-like compounds have been studied for a very long time, and we know they have a very broad and complex profile of biological activity spanning from things like enzyme induction to wasting syndrome and death. What my laboratory and the work that we'll be I'll be talking about and Rory will be talking about today is focused primarily on immune modulation by dioxins and dioxin-like compounds, primarily focused on B cells and antibody responses. And if we can go to slide 43, let me first begin by telling you a little bit about why we're focused on the B cell.
there are a number of reasons, and I want to just go through these very briefly. Probably one of the most important is that antibody responses have historically been one of the most sensitive sequelae or indicators of dioxin immunotoxicity and, in fact, dioxin toxicity. The concentrations and doses of dioxin that produce immune toxicity are about at the same order as induction of cytochrome P450-1A1, which is considered by most people in the field as kind of the gold standard in terms of dioxin exposure. Another reason we're focusing on the B lymphocyte or the B cell pertains to studies that were done many years ago by a number of laboratories looking specifically at the effects of dioxins on antibody responses to different defined antigens. And the reason that this is important, if we go to slide 44, you'll see on the right-hand side of the slide are a series of cartoons, and on the left-hand side you'll see some graphs. And basically what this illustrates, and this is actually from studies that were done many years ago that come from Mike Holzapfel's lab, is where the effects of dioxins were compared on these different defined antigens. And what the cartoons show is that they're, depending on the antigen that is used to induce an immune response, there are different cellular cooperativities that are required. So if you look at the very top cartoon, what we're looking at is a cartoon illustrating an immune response to a T-cell-dependent antigen, in this case, sheep erythrocytes. And these T-cell-dependent antigens, although the effector response is antibody production by a B cell, which is differentiated to a plasma cell, it requires accessory cells to help drive that antibody response, primarily macrophages, which act as antigen-presenting cells, as well as T cells, primarily T helper cells, which produce a variety of cytokines that help that B cell differentiation process. In contrast, if we think of an T cell independent antigen like DMP-ficol, this type of antigen doesn't require T cells, but does require macrophages to drive that response, primarily through the production of cytokines. One can also use polyclonal B cell activators like lipopolysaccharide. The cartoon at the very bottom helps to illustrate that there really is no cellular cooperativity required by other accessory cells. The point here is that if we look at the concentration response and the suppression that one sees of antibody responses to all three of these different types of B-cell stimuli, the concentration response and the sensitivity of the suppression of that antibody response is strikingly similar. And these very early studies suggested that, at least in terms of antibody responses, the B-cell was likely the primary target that was targeted by dioxin and dioxin-like compounds. If we go to the next slide, we have several other, I think, key observations that have led us to focus primarily on the B-cell. Again, there historically have been a number of studies that have taken spleens from, which is one of the primary lymphoid organs, from mice that were either treated with TCDD or vehicle, and these spleens were then fractionated into the various subpopulations being T cells, B cells, and macrophages from each of these treatment groups. And then one can reconstitute the various subpopulations in various combinations. So, for example, you can take B cells from a dioxin-treated animal and reconstitute with T cells and macrophages from a vehicle-treated animal and then activate that that cell culture system with a T-cell dependent antigen in vitro and look to see what combination of cells from which animals appear to be most sensitive. And basically what you can do by process of elimination is identify which cell types are actually driving the suppression of that antibody response by dioxins. And these studies always showed that when B cells were used from dioxin-treated animals and reconstituted with T cells and macrophages from vehicle-treated animals, a similar level of suppression of that antibody response was seen as if you didn't separate and reconstitute those cells, if you just took all of the cells from a dioxin-treated spleen. And so what that again showed was that just by process of elimination, the B cell appeared to be one of the primary cellular targets. More recently, some of the work from my laboratory as well as others have used both primary B cells that have been purified from the spleen of mice and treated in vitro with dioxins or B cell lines. And again, these studies have shown that in the absence of other cell types, you can demonstrate the same profile of immune suppression, primarily suppression of the IgM response. If we go to slide 46, this just recapitulates in a cartoon fashion what Mel Anderson introduced earlier on, and that is kind of the basics. Signaling cascade by which dioxin and dioxin-like compounds are believed to mediate most of their biological activity, and I'll just go through this very quickly. As Mel had described, dioxin and dioxin-like compounds, they cross the cell membrane rather easily because they're lipophilic, and they bind to this dioxin receptor called the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, which is a cytosolic receptor. Typically, it is part of a complex with other proteins, including heat shock protein 90 and ARA9 and some other less well-defined proteins. And then upon ligand binding, the AH receptor is activated. It sheds ARA9 and begins to translocate to the nucleus, where it also sheds these heat shock proteins. It dimerizes with ARNT, and then once the dimer is formed, it can then bind these dioxin response elements, which again Mel has already referred to, that are present in various regulatory regions within genes, either promoters or enhancers, to regulate gene transcription, either by inhibiting or inducing gene transcription. If we go to the next slide, which is 47, this is just, again, some data showing the role of the AH receptor in suppression of this IgM response by B cells. And what we're looking at here is data from two different cell lines. On the left are the CH12LX cells, which express AH receptor, and on the right is the BCL1 cell line, which does not express AH receptor, but does express ARNT. Both of these cell lines, in fact, do. And what this very nicely illustrates is that if we look at the left-hand side, the CH12 cells secrete a relatively modest amount of IgM, and this is an ELISA for IgM in the supernatant. And if we activate these cells with lipopolysaccharide, we can induce them to make relatively large amounts of IgM. And then if we add TCDD directly to these cultures, we can see that in a dose or a concentration-dependent manner, we can very robustly suppress that IgM response with relatively low concentrations of TCDD. As you can see, the suppression begins somewhere around 30 picomolar. T TCDD. On the right-hand side, the BCL1 cells, you can see that even at concentrations as high as 3 nanomolar TCDD, there is absolutely no effect on this IgM response, suggesting that the AH receptor is absolutely essential for the suppression of that response. If we can move to slide 48, this illustrates, again, in a cartoon fashion, what occurs in this antibody response. And if we look at the left-hand side of this cartoon, we can see that we start out with resting B cells, and these cells are quiescent and require a stimulation either by an antigen such as sheep erythrocytes or DNP-phycol or a polyclonal B cell activator like LPS. And once they encounter this type of a stimulus, they basically go through three stages, an activation stage, a proliferation stage, and ultimately differentiate into what are called plasma cells. And these plasma cells are terminally differentiated B cells that really have only one function, and that is to produce large amounts of immunoglobulin. In the primary antibody response, the immunoglobulin that is produced is primarily IgM. So our working hypothesis in terms of the suppression of the antibody response is that this primarily suppression by TCDD is primarily mediated through the disruption of this B cell differentiation process, which is critically dependent on the presence of the AH receptor. So if we go to slide 48, we are now beginning to look at what regulates in a signal transduction manner the differentiation of a resting B cell to a plasma cell. And this first cartoon illustrates some of the key regulators of this differentiation process. And we're starting right here with a resting B cell. And if we begin at the right-hand side of this cartoon, we see an IgM molecule that is basically made up of these individual antibodies that form a Y structure that are...
Norm, could I just interrupt you? This is slide 49. I think you said slide 48.
I'm sorry. We're on slide 49. This is an IgM molecule that is made up of a pentamer of these Y-shaped antibody molecules that are joined by what's called a J-chain. And each of these subunits is made up of a heavy chain and a light chain. And the genes that code for and express each of these chains in a resting cell is repressed by a transcription factor called PAX5, which stands for paired box gene 5. And so this makes sense because a resting B cell should not be producing large amounts of IgM. And another factor that is critical to the production of the IgM molecule and secretion is another factor called XBP1, which is Xbox protein 1. And so this protein is actually involved in the secretion of the IgM molecule. Now, what's important is that PAX5 regulates all four of these, the expression of, and of all four of these genes. And this makes sense because, again, the antibody molecule requires all three chains, and all three of these proteins have to be made simultaneously, and this antibody molecule has to be assembled inside the cell before it's secreted. So PAX5 in resting cells is expressed at a very high level to repress this antibody expression, these antibody, different antibody chains. And PAX5 is regulated by another transcriptional repressor called BLMP1, which, again, in a resting cell is expressed at a very low level, and it is repressed by BCL6, which is another transcriptional repressor. So as we look at this, you can see this is virtually like a series of negative switches that is controlling or keep maintaining this B cell in a resting, undifferentiated state. Now, if we go to slide 50, and we see now if we introduce an activation stimulus such as lipopolysaccharide, this initiates signaling cascades that induce the activation of AP1, which now increases BLMP1, which suppresses PAX5, and now releases the immunoglobulin genes from being repressed. So as we look at this cascade, both PAX5 and BLMP1 really represent critical control points in the differentiation process. If we now go to slide 51, we can see what occurs in the presence of TCDD, and we virtually have measured each one of these regulators now, and we find that in the presence of TCDD, we see a profile of activity at each of these stages which resembles more the resting B cell than the differentiated B cell, and in fact, the two key regulators, PAX5 and BLMP1, PAX5 is typically expressed at a relatively high level in the presence of TCDD, and BLMP1 is not expressed at a level that would normally be seen in cells that just received LPS. So one of the critical issues that we're trying to address is not only modeling this, but to try to understand where within the signaling cascade the AH receptor might be now interacting with this pathway to impair this B cell differentiation cascade. And if we just go to the last slide before I turn this over to Rory, just to summarize, so suppression of the IgM response by TCDD is mediated through direct effects on the B cell. It is AH receptor dependent, and it, in fact, does appear to be due in part, at least, to the impairment of B cell differentiation. And so with that, I'm going to turn this over to Rory, and I think he's going to focus more now on this pathway that I've just very briefly introduced, to tell you a little bit more about its regulation.
Okay, thanks, Norb. Are we going to take any questions now, Heather, or just keep going? I guess we're just going to keep going then. Didn't hear us. Okay, I'll pick it up from here. Moving on to slide 53, just the title, Computational Modeling. This is just makes the distinction that Norb's given you a very nice introduction to the relevant biology here of the B cell and of the effect of dioxin exposure on B cell differentiation. And several years ago now, it's actually going back 4 or 5 years before I came to work for the EPA, Norb and I and others, including Mel Anderson, worked together on the Superfund proposal that was subsequently funded. But at about that time, I left for EPA, so my involvement on this has continued in an informal way. But the original interaction back was prior to my joining the agency. That's just a bit of history in case you're wondering how I managed to get involved in all of this. So going to slide 54, and I'm clicking my slide a few times because it's one of these progressive disclosure slides. I think if you click it 3 times, everything comes up. You see on the left side of the figure the shadow outline of a human head with the brain inside, and this is the computer, of course, that we all use, and in the intuitive process of doing research, which is what those of us that are a bit older learned to do back in the 60s and 70s, and I suppose even into the early 80s before computers were cheap and widely available, we followed the scientific method and identified issues, developed hypotheses, conducted experiments, and which generated data, and then we could iterate this process around. But for the most part, the data evaluation and hypothesis revision, or hypothesis generation and then hypothesis revision, was largely an intuitive process. Of course, there is always some formal statistical evaluation of data, but this process in general is what I've called intuitive modeling. And then looking on the right side of this figure, and we're still on slide 54 here, with the advent of cheap computation, which in my life anyway started up in the early 1980s when I bought an IBM PC, one of the first ones that was available, it quickly became possible to encode in computer programs representations of hypotheses about the mechanisms of action of toxic chemicals. And this could include descriptions of pharmacokinetic behaviors, as was illustrated on Mel's slide for the PBPK model for dioxin. I've got a similar slide later in my talk. So that you could exercise the model in the computer and run a simulated experiment and generate simulated data. And we have found, those of us that have practiced this art over the years, have found that it's actually a viable way of complementing the classical process of collecting data in the laboratory. So that today we have a very viable two-pronged process for conducting research, and which involves both the classical laboratory experiment and data collection process. That certainly hasn't changed. It's just as important as it ever was. But in addition to that, we can sometimes obtain useful insights simply by simulating systems in the computer. And a lot of Mel's presentation was focused on this new option of learning about biological processes by simulating them in the computer. But keeping in mind that we're always going to want to reference data and be challenged by data. As Eddington said in the early 20th century, it's quite possible to be wrong whether you're a computational modeler or an experimentalist. And so this is one way of checking things to make sure that we're actually proceeding apace. Okay, moving on to slide 55, famous statistician George Box said, all models are wrong and some are useful, which is absolutely true. Every model tends to be an abstraction of the biology, and so that's what we mean by wrong. It's not that every model is necessarily incorrect in its detail, but there's always biological detail that we have to omit when we construct a model. So it's important that we ask, we're still on slide 56, but I've pressed the button again, it's ask not if the model is right, but can we learn something useful from it? So from my way of thinking about computational modeling in our work in toxicology and risk assessment is, are we learning useful things from these models? And invariably, the exercise of constructing these models and then trying to understand their predictions turns out to be enormously useful in helping us gain better understanding of the biology that we're trying to describe. Moving on to slide 57, so this is the philosophy slide of why we want to do computational modeling anyway. We've developed the model to help us better understand what the data can tell us. You can think of it as a sieve or a filter for the data to help us really get at the essence of what the data can tell us. Models are interpretive and predictive. If you use good modeling practice, and there's a literature on this that I'd be happy to direct people to if they're interested in it, you're more likely to uncover uncertainty by developing your model than introduce it. And the model is not actually required to be right. I would argue it's simply required to be better or more useful than not having any model at all. And again, those of us that have done this over the years, I think would all agree that the models that we've worked with and promoted, the ones we've managed to publish, are better than having no model at all. Moving on to slide 58, it's useful when thinking about the exposure response continuum, which is what we want to understand. We want to describe it in sufficient detail that we can understand dose response and understand time course, because these are key pieces of information we need to understand health risk. It's useful to break this continuum down into its pharmacokinetic, and pharmacodynamic components. And so in the, on this slide, you see, this is slide 58 now, you see the in green, the exposure, tissue dose, tissue interaction, oval representing or representing pharmacokinetics, and then the orange bar on the lower side of the lower, bottom right of the slide showing tissue interaction leading to early responses and irreversible pathology. And Mel showed a really a more sophisticated version of this same kind of slide. And I'm going to skip very quickly through these next couple of slides because Mel really covered this in his presentation. Here's the PBPK model for dioxin. This particular model has a spleen added to it. Sudhin Bhattacharya, who works at the Amner, added the spleen in so that we could actually predict dioxin delivery to the spleen, which, of course, is where you find a lot of B cells. Moving on to slide 60, this just shows the ability of that PBPK model to predict tissue beta for liver, fat, and spleen. So, again, nothing new here, given what Mel was showing you earlier. Quite powerful models for understanding tissue dosimetry. Moving on to slide 61, this is just to remind us that we want to know that pharmacokinetics up front because it's the tissue dose that becomes the driver for the subsequent events in the target tissue. And so moving on to slide 62, and this is one of Norb's slides, and this now is to really get to the nitty-gritty of our computational modeling collaboration with Norb and his B-cell studies. One can look at this diagram and see some arrows point up and some point down, and I think guys like Norb who have studied this system for years probably have a pretty good intuitive sense of how it behaves, but for those of us that are perhaps a bit less intimately familiar with this biology, it can be a challenge to see exactly how this system must be behaving, given that there's a lot of inhibitory interactions and we can stimulate the system one way or another. So by encoding this system in the computer, we can then very readily see how it behaves by running simulations using models of this system. And Cheng Zhang and Sudhin Bhattacharya at the Hamner have developed a series of models representing this signaling pathway with this core switch in the middle of it, the BCL6, PLIMP1, PAX5 switch. And so anything that changes the ability of PAX5 to inhibit the production of the various chains of the IgM molecule is going to affect the rate of immunoglobulin production. So moving on to slide 63, the implementation of the model that Sudhin and Cheng have developed allows us to generate one of these interesting plots. Mel showed one of these during his talk, where at the bottom you have the state of the undifferentiated B cell, and at the top you have the differentiated plasma cell, and the x-axis is the concentration of LPS, lipopolysaccharide, which stimulates a B cell to differentiate into a plasma cell. And if you follow the solid line along, you see as we increase the concentration of LPS, we initially stay in the undifferentiated B cell state. And then the broken red line denotes the jump or the switching as the biochemical switch is activated and the cell differentiates and becomes a plasma cell. And then what the analysis of the system using the computational model shows us is that if we then start reducing the concentration of LPS, that the plasma cell doesn't simply fall back to becoming an undifferentiated cell. This could only happen, and you can actually do this with the modeling, this could only happen if you could somehow or other achieve a negative concentration of lipopolysaccharide. So what this analysis of the model tells us is that the plasma cell is an irreversibly differentiated cell type, and it won't fall back even if we completely remove the lipopolysaccharide. So this is now nothing more than a confirmation of something the biologists knew already, but this kind of analysis is quite powerful in helping us understand from this rigorous quantitative perspective how the system behaves. Moving on to slide 64, now we consider what happens when we stimulate the system with lipopolysaccharide LPS, and then the arrows in front of BLIMP1 and PAX5 are changing. If we end up down-regulating PAX5, then we start to impair its ability to inhibit the production of the IgM, of the IgH, IgL, and IgG. which means that we could produce IgM, right? So moving on to slide 64, we know that part of the signaling involved in this process for the lipopolysaccharide stimulation of that biochemical switch involves activation of the AP1 complex, which is its turn mediated by MAP kinases. And Mel also talked about MAP kinases and the kind of ultra-sensitivity and bistability involved in MAP kinase signaling. And moving on to slide 66, this slide just illustrates the production of a phosphorylated MAP kinase as a function of an input pulse. So on the, you see the input pulse at the bottom. It's a short input pulse. And then you see a series of lines that evolve over time. You see a series of lines that just show little bits but then stay down running along the x-axis. And what we're looking at is each line represents increasing intensity of the input pulse. And what the way the MAP kinase system behaves is that when the intensity of the input pulse becomes sufficiently strong or sufficiently intense, the system flips. It doesn't change continuously. It actually jumps from one state to the other, and that has to do with the positive feedback of the system, the ultrasensitivity of the change, and then the positive feedback to help maintain that change. So that the MAP kinase is like a light switch on your wall. It's not like a gas pedal on your car, where as you gradually press the gas pedal, you'll go faster. It's like a light switch. It's either on or it's off, and there isn't an in-between state. So moving on to slide 67, when we code up our computational model with the BLIMP1 PAX5 switch in it, we and the kind of signaling I was just talking about with respect to MAP kinase, we see the model predicting a similar behavior for BLIMP1 activation as a function of exposure to LPS. So here you see a family of curves, some of which stay low along the x-axis, and then as we go to higher doses of LPS, it flips up. So there are differences in the time course of the change, but there is no intermediate state. It either flips or it doesn't flip. And so now moving on to the next slide, slide 68, this is where outputs of the model are compared to some of the data generated by Norba and his colleagues at Michigan State University. In the top panel, you see time, and then various concentrations of LPS that were used to stimulate the B cells, and then the resulting development of plasma cells over time. And you see a family of curves that's dose responsive. The higher levels of exposure to LPS are generating a higher production of plasma cells. And in the bottom is a simulation generated from the model. So the model actually is able to do a nice job of recapitulating the data. Moving on to slide 69. So far we haven't actually talked about dioxin. And so the last part of my presentation then we'll burrow down and get to this question of, so what do we really understand about how dioxin is inhibiting this system? And I should say now, perhaps I should have said this at the start of my presentation, that what we've been going through is an example of how if we really want to understand dose response, we actually need to understand the underlying biology of the system that we're interested in studying. And so much of the effort in Norb's lab at Michigan State has been to characterize this relevant B cell biology and certainly not to in any sense ignore the concerns for dioxin, but just to understand that if we want to understand how dioxin impairs the differentiation of B cells, we've got to understand a lot about that differentiation process. And that's where all the studies of BCL6, of BLIMP1, and PAX5 have come in and why these have been conducted. We do know, and now this is now looking at slide 69, that dioxin somehow or other interferes with the ability of LPS to throw the switch. There are some data suggesting that dioxin interacts with AHR, and that this may impair the ability of LPS to signal through AP1. So we have coded up a version of our computational model that describes this kind of inhibitory effect of dioxin after it binds to its receptor, the AHR receptor, to the receptor orexin receptor complex would then interfere with the ability of LPS to activate AP1. Moving on to slide 70. And so we can then ask very detailed questions since we have the computational model and it's relatively straightforward to code up possible hypotheses. We can ask questions about exactly how dioxin and its dioxin receptor complex might interfere with AP1 activation. So we can code up alternative models. One possibility is that that interference is MAP kinase-like. There's a switch-like process where dioxin is actually able to switch the effect of LPS on AP1 on or off, or perhaps it's something continuous. We actually don't have a good molecular-level understanding yet of exactly how dioxin interferes with these processes. And what I'm illustrating for you is the opportunity here to construct hypotheses in the computer models and make predictions of behaviors, because it's these predictions then where we can go back to the laboratory and see and try to evaluate how the actual biological system behaves and compare it to computer-based prediction. This is a way then of trying to conduct the research efficiently, because we can ask some of these questions first in the computer. So moving on to slide 71, we know that, and Mel showed this slide in his presentation, we know that the induction process for cytochrome P451A1 in the liver is switch-like, and we hypothesize that a similar kind of behavior is expected in B-cell differentiation for the effect of AH1 of dioxin, rather. But we haven't actually clearly demonstrated that yet. In fact, we had a series of discussions earlier this week about go-forward experiments on exactly how we can characterize the dose response for effects of dioxin on B-cell differentiation. So what are some of the research needs then on this question of how dioxin affects B cell differentiation? We actually need a more complete mapping than we have at present of how dioxin-mediated signaling interacts with the signaling involved in differentiation of B cells. Where does dioxin-mediated signaling interact with the lipopolysaccharide mediated signaling that activates the switch?
Rory, if I could jump in, your audio is dropping off a little bit.
Sorry, I'll try to keep the phone in front of me here.
Thanks. And I'm back, by the way.
How does dioxin affect gene expression? Is it a gas pedal or a light switch? Much of Mel Anderson's work suggests that it's light switch-like, that it's on or off. And the involvement of MAP kinase in some of the signaling that's likely to be mediated by dioxin would provide a capability for light switch-type signaling. And one point that needs to be made, and this really is different, I would say, from possibly 10 years ago, and if you've been in the field long enough, you know we've been worried about dioxin for a lot longer than 10 years, is that technologies are really available today to map out these signaling pathways and to understand quantitatively and to understand them qualitatively and to understand them quantitatively, to construct the models and to collaboratively interact with the experiments in the laboratory to really nail down how the dose response really does play out. So moving on to slide 73, this is just an example of some predictions then that the model that Sudan and Chung have running in over at the Hamner can make predictions of dose time response surfaces for B cell activation. The Z axis, the vertical axis here is the plasma cell response with both TCDD and LPS on different axes. And you see as the time course progresses from 0 hours to 24, 48 to 72, the top right surface comes up where we have the maximum exposure to LPS and the minimum exposure to dioxin. So we're generating modeling predictions here that we can then go back to the laboratory and test. And on slide 74, this just illustrates the iterative process between the laboratory and the computational modeling. And this is the paradigm, if you will, that we're following now and trying to nail down some of these nitty-gritty questions about the dose response for dioxin. And just to summarize then on slide 75, dose response is a function of biological mechanisms. That's why extensive resources are used to try and understand the relevant biology as part of this study. Computational models of these mechanisms improve efficiency of research and provide a capability for prediction. And even though years and years of research have been done on dioxin, we still need an improved quantitative and qualitative understanding of how the dioxin AHR complex interacts with AP1 and other sites in the D-cell differentiation program. And I think Mel acknowledged Cheng Zhang and Sudhin Bhattacharya, but I'll do it here too, because they've just been key players in the computational modeling work that I've described for you. A couple of very talented guys over at the Hamner. And I think that's my last slide. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Rory. That was a great, and Dr. Kaminsky, that was a great overview of the research that you're doing. At this point, we can forward just one more slide to 77, and that gives information about the next computational toxicology session coming up. And very importantly, slide number 79, which tells you about the links to additional resources and the feedback form. And before we open the questions, I just want to let you know a little bit about that. We do assemble resources directly applicable to the topic that was discussed today. So if you go to the links to additional resources, you'll see what we've listed there. Some of the questions that come up that perhaps the investigators feel like an additional paper would be good to post, they'll go ahead and do that and post it on the additional resources page. And it'll stay with that. It'll stay anyhow, the access to that link will stay updated with the presentation forever. So you can always access it. Also, there will be an audio archive of this presentation in the future. Usually takes about 3 weeks for that to process, and that'll be available through the CLUIN website. Anyway, associated with the links page is an online feedback form, and we ask that you consider please filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments, and we continue to improve the content and delivery of these seminars. So please consider completing the feedback form. So at this point, I want to allow people from the phone to ask a question if they have any questions for the two speakers who just spoke, Dr. Kaminsky and Dr. Connolly. If you do, take your phone off mute, state your name and your organization, and go ahead and ask your question. Okay, while the people on the phones are thinking about a question to ask, I'll go ahead and ask a question that was submitted by a simulcast participant. This is from Jerry Black from Black & Associates in Norman, Oklahoma. He wants to know, how will this study relate to understanding of other chemicals such as PCB or PCP?
You want to handle that, Norm, or Mel?
Well, I can take a stab at it. PCBs that act as ligands for the AH receptor, I think once we've characterized and developed computational descriptions of the effects of TCDD on this pathway, we can certainly then adapt it to other dioxin-like compounds. And I think there the differences would be in terms of differences between TCDD and some of these other compounds would be more in terms of their affinity for the AH receptor, and that I think that can be modeled as well. So I think once we have the pathways described, we can then adapt them not only to other compounds, but I think we might even be able to adapt them to mixtures, which is one of the long-term goals of this work.
Are there any other questions from the phone line? If there are, you can take your phone off mute by pressing *6, state your name and your organization, and ask your question.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. You mentioned how in the intuitive and traditional modeling, you had a hypothesis. How important is it now to a different way of doing things in computational biology? I think some people think that part is being left behind.
This is Rory Conley. I'll take a stab at answering your question. I like to think of the computational model as a formal representation of your hypothesis. In the case of a PBPK model, for example, the hypothesis would be that, for example, the cytochrome is induced in the liver, and that explains that nonlinear dose response for the concentration of dioxin in the liver, and also that the solubility of dioxin in the different tissues must be described accurately. And so you have sort of a general pharmacokinetic mechanism that you hypothesize, and you code that up, and it predicts the measured pharmacokinetic data very nicely. So really the model is the hypothesis, and while that's true for pharmacokinetic mechanisms, it's just also as true for the pharmacodynamic mechanisms that we're just starting to really try to deal with now. We can generate hypotheses, code them up as computer programs, observe how they behave, and then look to real data to make the comparisons, and that's a way to reject hypotheses, to find that they fail to meet up with the data, or if we get lucky, we find we have concordance, and then we might think of more detailed studies to further test and refine that particular description.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, Rory, I think what we presented here as this case study is, I think, a very good example, too, with the overall hypothesis being that TCDD impairs B-cell differentiation, and we've now tried to describe that pathway not only computationally, but we've begun measuring each of those factors under various conditions during the B-cell differentiation process and are now feeding that information back into the computational description. So I think, as Rory, I think, tried to illustrate, it's not only an iterative process, but it is certainly very, very strongly grounded in a basic hypothesis.
May I also make a comment? This is Mel.
Of course.
I think part of this question goes back to some of the descriptions of what we mean by systems biology, systems toxicology. What I've been describing and what we've been talking about today is mostly a computational systems biology, which really moves forward from specific hypotheses to describe systems and what they might do. But there is a larger community that defines systems biology as a collection of broad data sets on transcriptomics, metabolomics, and proteomics, and other high-throughput technologies. And it's in that context that people often talk about hypothesis neutral. That is, instead of focusing heavily on a single hypothesis, collect enough information to really understand broadly what's going on within a system. And I would say that in those areas, this idea of retreating from hypotheses till you get a broader data set to narrow down what might be going on is right now being called a hypothesis-neutral approach. And what we're doing is just, I think, very much the opposite. It's hypothesis-driven for falsification of ideas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I add one other part? I'm interested in knowing what your perception is of the future as far as regulatory biology and how we will use system biology and computational biology to set standards for regulating pesticides and food additives and such.
Well, maybe I'll take a first stab at that question. One of the other long-term goals, again, of this project, and I think it could be applied to virtually any xenobiotic and hopefully down the road to mixtures, is that much of what we've done here can also be done using primary human cells, and especially the immunotoxicology lends itself very well to this because you can obtain leukocytes from peripheral blood. And so some of that work actually is also going on as part of our Superfund grant, as well as some collaborations with the Dow Chemical Company, where we're beginning to move much of these types of approaches into human primary cells. And I think that will be extremely valuable long-term in terms of trying to assess and establish some boundaries around risk.
Mel or Rory, would you like to take a stab at that too?
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. From my point of view, these tools offer significant opportunities for providing an understanding of dose-response relationships, mechanistic opportunities to understand them that we just have not had before. And to the extent that they're aggressively and systematically used for multiple cellular and multicellular responses, and to the extent that the regulatory community stays open to having biologically oriented risk assessments and rather than statistically oriented ones, then it offers great, great opportunities for really providing a much better basis for regulation in the future.
Maybe I'll add my 2 cents worth. I should note that I'm an EPA employee, and I'm just stating my own opinions here and certainly not any policy of the agency. I'm very excited about the idea that in the real world, the shapes of those response curves is massively impacted at the lower levels of exposure by this adaptive biology that we have built into every cell in our bodies. And that we now know how to do the studies that need to be done to characterize that biology experimentally, and that we know how to construct the computational models of that biology, link it up with pharmacokinetic models, and start to predict dose response from a very biological perspective. This work is ongoing now. I think we sort of have a sense of how to go forward with it. And as Mel said, you know, I hope that that everybody, both who might be doing this kind of work and those that might be users of it or consumers of it at some point, will be open to the kind of the real possibility we have here to regulate chemicals from a biological perspective, which I believe is the way we need to go forward with this.
Thanks. I think we have time for maybe one more question. If anyone out there has a question, you can unmute your phone line by pressing *6. State your name and your organization and go ahead and ask a question. Okay, it's gotten quiet. I'll give one more chance. Those on the phone line. Well, it sounds like we've exhausted all the curiosities out there. We did get not a question, but a comment from Barry Moyer from Maine Department of Environmental Protection in Augusta, Maine. And he noted that Rory mentioned he could provide references of good modeling practice. And Rory, is that something that we could post on the additional resources?
Yeah, I'll send you a couple of citations on that.
Okay, that would be great. And we'll post that there for everyone to have a look at.
Okay, I'd be happy to do that.
Thanks.
Heather, may I take a moment for just unprincipled advertisement?
Absolutely.
Okay. As part of my presentation, I gave a web link to the Hamner webpage that actually describes the course in computational systems biology and dose response that was provided last year and this year. And when I say describes, it's actually there in its entirety, with the exception of the running models that were required for afternoon computing exercises. It includes a suggested reading list that covers all of the key ideas that I provided, as well as a glossary of definitions that are important for computational systems biology, and kind of full PDFs of all the lectures that were given. People may find it useful, and people are welcome to take it and download it and use it as they see fit, as long as they attribute it.
Okay. Great. And do you have any upcoming classes that you want to let people know about?
We're going to repeat the course at the end of September, and it will be advertised broadly at the Society of Toxicology, Society of Risk Analysis, and on our website at the www.thehamner.org.
Okay, and we can put that link to your curriculum materials on the additional resources.
Yes, you may.
Great.
Can I ask one additional question?
Sure.
Maybe part of the ETA. If you had a certain amount of money, maybe $1 million, where would you spend it?
This is hypothetical?
Uh-huh. Okay, make it $3 million.
Is this with respect to dioxin specifically or something else?
Well, actually, respect to the basic research that you would see done in this area. And it can be your field.
Well, I'll start there. I'm a real advocate of moving a lot of our toxicology work into human primary models. And I really see that as being important, and I think there's a lot of opportunities now to do that as the availability of human tissues is more readily accessible.
Thank you.
And this is Mel. So I've just spent the last 5 years of my life being involved with this effort by the National Academy of Sciences, Toxicity Testing in the 21st Century, A Vision and a Strategy.
Mm-hmm.
That document suggests that in the future we should be able to do toxicity testing using human cells or cell aggregates, doing tests very frequently in vitro, and then interpreting them if we develop the systems models for the circuitry and how they're perturbed, as well as how they move from an adapted to an adverse situation, much of what you've heard today. If I had $3 million, I'd try to pick one of the chemicals as an example and try to run it through that battery of tests, including in vitro, in vivo kinetic extrapolation, and develop the risk paradigm that would use that information in a regulatory setting. I might need a few more dollars, though.
Okay.
Norb, you didn't answer that yet. If you have a...
No, I think I answered it first.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Maybe it was Rory.
I was Rory that kept quiet, but...
Okay.
I think the question's been answered well enough with Norb and Mel's inputs on it.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. So unless there are any other dying questions, I think we're at a point now where we can conclude this seminar. And again, I'd like to thank our speakers today, Dr. Kaminsky, Dr. Anderson, and Dr. Connolly. And we thank everybody out there for their participation and to the Kluin staff for helping give the seminar. So thanks very much, everyone. And at this, we'll conclude the seminar and say goodbye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.